Africa, J. Naidu. President and Executive Director, Heart File, Dr. Sania Nishtar. Executive Director, UNICEF, Anne Veneman. And our moderator, host, All Things Considered, National Public Radio, Michelle Norris.
Good morning. Have you not had your coffee this morning? Maybe we should try that again. Good morning. It is a good morning. As you just heard, I'm Michelle Norris. I host a little show on National Public Radio called All Things Considered. I am so pleased to be able to participate in the Clinton Global Initiative, and in particular in a discussion on this very important topic. We're talking about many things while we're here today, about sustainability, about poverty alleviation, about global climate change. None of those things are really possible unless people have the most basic of their needs met, simple needs like nutrition. And we all know that across the world, last night, millions of children went to bed not knowing if they were going to have anything to eat in the morning. And millions of parents woke up with a pain in their stomach, not just a hunger pain, but a real emotional pain because they knew that they're not able to feed their families. Millions, specifically 850 million people, are hungry and overweight across the world. And 2 billion people are deficient in one or more micronutrients. And we're going to hear much more about that. Hunger and malnutrition kill more people than AIDS, than malaria, and tuberculosis combined. At the same time, high-calorie diets and a sedentary lifestyle are leading to an explosion of obesity, an explosion of obesity in places where malnutrition is also a problem. This session will discuss the need to address both over- and under-nutrition. We hope to touch your minds, and we also hope to touch your hearts. We hope that these words will lead to action on your part. And we're going to begin our discussion with Bernard, with Jay, with Sonia, and with Anne. And I want to begin by asking each of you, and I'm going to begin at the end, Bernard, with you, to tell us a little bit, each of you, about your work, and briefly about your work. And then in doing so, let's start on a fairly hopeful note, and tell us about the one thing you found in your work that you're excited about, because it's either easy to replicate in other places or because it's something that is cost-effective. Bernard, let's start with you.
Well, as a food company, what Danone is doing, is trying to do, is to combine the business approach to tackle malnutrition. And what we are doing particularly, especially in Asia, in Bangladesh, for example, is how we can create what we call a social business, which is combining a high impact on malnutrition for kids, but also the advantages of a viable, sustainable business model. We believe that the solution is not to distribute food, is to help local communities to create sustainable business model in manufacturing raw materials, local raw materials. So what we have done in Bangladesh is creating with Grameen Bank, in cooperation with the support of Mohamed Yunus, a new business model, and we have built a new factory in the north of Bangladesh, and we are now expanding, we want to expand this model throughout the country in the coming years, but also outside Bangladesh, Asia, and Africa, with the support of a fund. We have created a fund to invest in such new social businesses.
And the one thing that you found in that work that makes you excited about the future?
I think what is important is that we can combine locally, for example, in our business, it's about dairy product. It's about producing yogurt with micronutrients, so fortified with vitamin and mineral, plus the benefits for the kids of living ferments. So if you tackle this issue, you can combine the development of upstream family farming plus the advantage of creating jobs in a small factory plus distribution. And this type of business model is not an easy one because you have to come to a very affordable price at the end of the value chain. But it's something that we can replicate quite easily in different types of countries of the world.
And as I understand, the key is that you use milk produced by local farmers. So you're creating jobs also.
It's an entirely local supply chain with micro factories, micro farms, micro factories, and distribution by the Grameen ladies from door to door. So with a very special approach to marketing that we have developed in cooperation with GAIN to provide information and education to those women that will sell the product and who understand the benefits of the product.
Jay.
Well, I think your introduction was really important because I think the most dehumanizing thing in the world is not being able to put a meal on the table at the end of a day. And that's, I think, something we have got to address. The important thing about GAIN is that we are primarily an alliance. We bring together partners in the public and the private sector, in the civil society, and many of you, and even on this panel, are really partners that we work with very closely to see the way in which we could crowd in particularly the private sector into delivering public goods, into creating the type of products that Bernard talked about that meet the needs of those that are at the bottom of the pyramid. And I think that's the most rewarding thing one could get. You know, I was recently with a delegation of GAIN in India, launching an Indian business alliance of GAIN. And we visited a project where we're working in Andhra Pradesh with an NGO set up by the private sector that is doing school feeding. And we went to the operation at 3 o'clock in the morning. They prepare 130,000 meals that are delivered hot to each and every school in Hyderabad. And it's a balanced diet. It's fortified. We worked with Britannia, which is a biscuit manufacturer, where they add that to the diet. So at the end of the day, when you see those kids, because we went to one of the schools, this is the only meal they get for one day. And that's the reason why they come to school, why girls in particular come to school. So it encourages parents to send their children to school because they know that's where they're going to get fed. It helps education. So there's a multiplier effect, and it makes business sense. At the end of the day, Danone may make very little investment except the social return in Bangladesh from the Grameen project that they're doing. But they're creating a brand for Grameen, for Danone. And if you're a clever business person, you know, you cannot exclude 2 billion people from your market that you are targeting. So it makes eminent sense to say we can work in a smart way with private sector to use the market innovation and the technological and managerial, you know, expertise to address those that are living in poverty. And we need government. In the developing world, and in a large part, Michelle, of this conversation has ignored the fact that government is so central in the developing world, we need government to create the policy and regulatory framework that levels the playing field. And I think that's the role that GAIN plays, and that's the role, besides that role, the role we play in financial assistance is actually quite minimal.
We'll return to that, the question of government and distribution. But first, Sonia.
Well, in terms of the first part of your question, I am the founder of a health sector think tank within Pakistan. I'm based in the civil society because normally NGOs in the developing world are usually outreach-based, but we work in the area of policy and strategy. And we basically advocate for health reform in a country that is pursuing policies of liberalization, privatization, and deregulation. And we are trying to find equitable solutions to the health for all strategy in a contemporaneous world through innovative approaches. Now, one of the things as part of the overall scope of the organization that we do is also to reorient priorities in health based on the prevailing evidence. And many years ago, we noticed that 54% of the mortality in Pakistan is due to non-communicable diseases, and it contributes to 46% of the burden of disease. Now, for those of you who may want a clarification, non-communicable diseases are diseases which are not spread from person to person, and you generally class cardiovascular diseases, heart diseases, diabetes, cancers, and some chronic respiratory conditions in that category. So we tried to advocate for a change in public health priorities, and after a long battle, we were able to provide strategic inputs into the development of what then came to be known as the National Action Plan on Chronic Disease Prevention, Control, and Health Promotion. Of course, we still have a long way to go because the program is very small in terms of budgetary allocations and in terms of institutional size if you compare it with the other programs on tuberculosis, HIV, and maternal and child health. But it is a modest beginning. And what we advocate for is policy change, is institutional change, is legislative change in a number of different areas. And I guess the reason why I got invited on this panel was more in relation to the work on non-communicable diseases and addressing obesity as one of the four biological risk factors as opposed to the other line of work that we do in health reform. Now, in terms of the second part of your question about what excites me in terms of its potential to scale up, I would have to say there are various components of the program, as I outlined. It's legislative change is one of them. Regulation is another. One side of it is, of course, behavioral change, communication, and how you impact the behaviors and practices of communities. But one component of it is how to leverage the existing healthcare providers at the grassroots level to deliver preventive health messages that are relevant both to over and under nutrition. And there we have been able to incorporate the prevention of non-communicable diseases and, of course, messages that are relevant to obesity reduction and overweight reduction into the work plan of healthcare providers at the community level whose primary mandate was to work in maternal and child health and, of course, undernutrition. And although I do not have sound statistics to report from, but the initial process-related results are extremely encouraging. And I'm quite convinced, and coming back to a comment that one of the panelists made on the health systems panel yesterday about all the vertical programs ultimately getting integrated at the health worker level, I'm convinced that programs, different vertical programs, be they HIV, be they tuberculosis, or whether they're non-communicable disease related, addressing obesity and others in the domain of undernutrition, can actually get integrated at the grassroots level where you optimize resources. The other point that I'd like to make is just connecting back with what Jay said about the role of governments. Of course, the civil society can play a role, but ultimately it is the mandate of governments to provide health as a public good to citizens. And we can catalyze change. We can play our part in terms of technical support, in terms of advocating for change. But it is absolutely critical that you find institutionally viable and sustainable solutions to integrate both dimensions of over and under nutrition, both of which form the spectrum of malnutrition.
Thank you, Sonia. And could you give us a brief overview of your work at UNICEF and also the one thing that gives you hope looking forward?
Well, thank you very much. UNICEF, as you know, is the United Nations Children's Agency, so our central mission is first and foremost children. We work primarily in the areas of healthcare, education, and protection of children. And nutrition is an integral part of the health of a child. Certain measures of what we look at, under 5 mortality is a key measure. There are about 10 million children who die every year of largely preventable causes, primarily disease and malnutrition. 53% of those deaths, malnutrition is a contributing cause. It is not the only cause, but if you have malaria and malnutrition, you're more likely to die of the disease. So the nutrition aspect of health is critical. We also very much promote the concept that was just discussed on integrated approaches. It's very important that prenatal care, getting to the pregnant woman before she has the child to make sure she has proper nutrition so that she's more likely to give birth to a healthy child, is critical to the overall health of the child. And then to ensure that the child has proper nutrition, especially one of the most important interventions in preventing under 5 mortality is exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months. And so that is something that UNICEF works very hard in an integrated community-based approach to really promote with women, working with behavior change and so forth. When you look at the prevalence of under 5 underweight around the world, which is the measure that is one of the key indicators for the nutrition Millennium Development Goal, you see very interesting statistics. I find it really quite amazing that India, this is a country where the first meeting I had with the health minister, he wanted to talk to me about his problem with obesity in children. And yet our indicators show that 47% of under fives are underweight in India. Now this compares to in sub-Saharan Africa on average of 28%. And it's almost mind-boggling to think about the country that was the most successful country in the Green Revolution, now a food exporter, has 47% of their children under 5 underweight. Many, many of these issues relate to behavioral changes. How do we change things like getting women to exclusively breastfeed? How do we change attitudes about early marriage, about feeding children in general? In terms of your second question, what are some of the most promising things I've seen? One of the things I have seen during my time at UNICEF for a little over 2 years that has really come to the forefront are ready-to-use therapeutic foods. And these are basically, it's a small sachet packet that tastes like very sweet peanut butter but contains high-calorie, high-nutrition vitamins, minerals. It was shown in Niger about 2 years ago to have about a 95% success rate in treating severely malnourished children without putting them in the hospital. Now, that's real results. And now we're seeing plants being developed. There's one that was just opened in Ethiopia in February. There's one in Malawi. There's one in Niger. This is a French company. Primarily, it's been exported. But now the production is starting to take place in Africa. And these ready-to-use therapeutic foods are a key component of being able to treat malnutrition.
Can I just ask, is it almost like a fruit roll-up or something like the goo if you're a runner that you would sort of open up and just almost slurp right out of the package?
Yeah, exactly, but it's not like a fruit roll-up. It's more like a peanut butter that's very sweet that you would suck out of the package. And it's, unfortunately, I didn't bring it back today. I could have.
For show and tell.
But it is, you know, when you see these kinds of results, I think it's very important to look at this. We do a lot of purchases. We're the largest purchaser. UNICEF is the largest purchaser of vaccines throughout the developing world. We're also one of the largest purchasers now of these ready-to-use therapeutic foods for treatment of severely malnourished children. And so that's a very key component. Let me just mention one other component in nutritional diseases, and that is the lack of clean water throughout the developing world causes so many of the nutritional problems because the diarrheal diseases really sap your system of the nutrition that it needs.
Now, before we go on after our introductory remarks, a little bit of business. We want to hear from all of you. And at the table, you should find 3x5 cards or note cards. And if you have a question, and we hope that you will have many questions or thoughts about this, we very much want to hear from you. And so we are encouraging you to jot them down and then hand them to your facilitator. Each table has a facilitator. They will then pass them on to us, and that's our opportunity to bring you into this discussion. Jay, I just noticed that you had something to say.
Yes, just to follow up on what Anna said, because in a sense, for gain, UNICEF is our key partner. In fact, I was persuaded by UNICEF to chair GAIN. So in that sense, there are success stories. You know, South Africa, where I come from, I know best, took a decision to fortify all staple foods, which are maize flour and wheat flour. We brought together industry, government, and civil society. UNICEF was the implementing agency. We provided an input of $3 million, mainly on social marketing and advocacy, to get the issue on the radar screen. And today, 96% of all maize meal and wheat flour is fortified. We're 3 years down the line. We can exit, and we are now collecting the data, the initial data, because the flour is fortified with folic acid, vitamin A, and potassium. The initial data coming out is that there's been up to, in many areas, a 30% reduction in neural birth defects. Now, a similar example is soya sauce in China, and the pilots are a bit staggering, sometimes equivalent to the population of other countries. So, but the pilots on soya sauce, where we're adding iron, has again indicated close to 20% reduction in anemia. This is after 2 to 3 years. And the cost of it, I mean, we are doing a project, Anne and I us have discussed a project on completing iodization of salt. Now, salt for, and I was talking to someone this the other day who was a very senior person who didn't understand why we iodize salt. Because it's now out of the memory of people. We take it for granted here. But, you know, without salt iodization, we have mental retardation, we have goiter, we have a range of iodine deficiency diseases. Now, the cost of completing the job is 0.5 cents, it's 5 cents, sorry, 5 cents per person per year. On average, the cost of providing these micronutrients is between 15 and 20 cents per person per year. And last point there was, there's a body, a Copenhagen consensus. It was a body of Nobel laureates and economists who were asked a question. If you had $50 billion to change, to make an impact on development, what would you do? And I suppose they debate a lot, but they came to a conclusion quite quickly that they would intervene on HIV/AIDS and they would intervene on micronutrient deficiencies, because this is the hidden hunger that we face. And we could very cost effectively deal with the entire population of 2 billion people who are at risk and resolve this issue. And the cost would be minimal.
Now, I want to return to something that Bernard talked about, the work with Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank, and this, the work you have to do to bring your investors on board, because in a case like that, you're creating social capital, but the return on the investment may not be great.
You're right. It's a very important constraint. In a way, we are creating social value, but the Danone shareholders, what do they expect? Danone is a high profitability company. We are playing the role of the financial market. So why do we invest in such a social venture? In fact, we consider that if we keep it inside our core business, there will be a kind of bottleneck. So we created a special fund. We call it Danone Communities, a Danone Venture Social Fund, not a philanthropic, not a charity. It's to invest in business. But we know that the financial return will be lower in the short term. It's about 3% if we succeed in Bangladesh, for example. We just want to finance the construction of new micro plants in the coming years. And so we have created this fund to say, well, to talk to our shareholders. Our shareholders get a dividend each year, and we tell them, hey, if you're interested to participate in this social venture, you can invest a part of your dividend in Danone Communities. And this fund will be open, is already open to our employees, not only to our shareholders, to our employees, to our consumers. It's a public fund, it's a mutual fund, and we say we will invest in new ventures. And then we take some freedom, some liberty to explore new ways of doing business. Otherwise, if you keep it in the constraint of the financial return of the financial markets, it's very hard because you will dilute your profitability when you succeed. Imagine that the plan we have in Bangladesh is to build 50 micro factories in the 10 coming years. Our shareholders could complain and say, okay, guys, you're succeeding very well. You are building the brand in Bangladesh. But what is the return for us? So we split it from the core business and we say, We will provide to the fund all the competencies, the expertise of the company, but it will be a social capital. And I think this is a message I would like to deliver today. Between classical philanthropy and normal financial market, there is a way to explore, which is social investment. And there are a lot of creativity to exert on that and to find new ways. With the non-communities, we say we will invest in communities locally in Bangladesh, in Africa, and elsewhere. But also, we want to mobilize a community of the people in the financial community, among our employees, among our consumers, who are really interested and motivated for this new approach to business.
Some in the audience may be surprised that we're here today talking about undernutrition and overnutrition, that we're carrying this concomitant conversation. And help us understand how we got to this point, that these two things are happening often at the same time in the same place.
Well, I think that it is a very difficult issue when you look, for example, in our own country, in the United States, we have a growing obesity crisis among children and adults, for that matter, that is driven primarily by more and more ready-to-eat foods, children not eating proper nutrition, lack of fruits and vegetables, and lack of physical activity. It's a fairly simple formula. Despite continued research on the dietary guidelines, we've continued to see obesity rise. We've continued to see the difficult issue of what children are eating, whether or not they're able to control what children eat, and more attention being focused in the media on these very issues. One of the things that President Clinton has been able to do that I think is very important is begin to engage the food companies in a dialogue about advertising about some of these non-nutritious foods in the media that appeals to children. And I think that's one of the things that has to be looked at along with how to promote better use of fruits and vegetables. I see Gary Nell here. They turned the Cookie Monster into a promoter of eating fruits and vegetables. He now says cookies are a sometimes food. But when you look at a country like India, where you've got growing incomes in much of the population, but a billion people in that country, and still you have obese children growing at remarkable rates, along with this 47% under 5 underweight. It's the difference in culture. It's the caste system. It's a difference in the kind of way people live their lives. And it isn't really quite easily explainable because the foods that some people are eating are just not the right kinds of foods and causing the malnutrition.
I just wonder if the NGOs and the government and the community that provides aid can be part of the problem in some cases. Just to use the U.S. as an example, among the poorest populations who move away from rural areas and into the city and a dependency on social welfare programs, people are not eating off the land as much. They're eating much more pre-processed food. If you go to places like Mississippi, where malnutrition was a great problem, now obesity is now the central problem because so many people are eating prepackaged foods. Is that something you think about in the delivery of food aid?
I want to answer your question, but I just have a follow-up comment to what Anne has so well summarized. Relevant to the issue that you raised about the coexistence of undernutrition and obesity, I think it's important to see issues over a spectrum. At one end of the extreme end of the spectrum, you have diseases, you have areas of the world, parts of the world, where you see hunger coexisting, you know, in post-conflict situations and in countries that have undergone prolonged durations of famine. So that's one end of the spectrum. At the other extreme of the spectrum, you have countries where food security is not an issue. So you predominantly see obesity as a problem, not so much undernutrition. But, of course, within isolated pockets, you do see undernutrition. There can be no generalizations. You know, the generalizations have their limitations. But for the main chunk of the world, you see the problem coexisting for the major part of the low- and middle-income countries. These are countries which, on the one hand, have rampant levels of poverty, illiteracy, where food security has not been achieved by governments. And on the other hand, there are a parallel set of phenomena that are happening in coexistence with that. For instance, such countries are undergoing rapid shifts in demographics and their epidemiological patterns. There's rapid urbanization and industrialization, as a result of which people have sedentary lifestyles. There's access to mechanized transport. Such countries are opening up their economies, and under the influences of globalization, you see that access to and availability of high energy, dense, high calorie foods is there. So in these countries, you see a coexistence of abject levels of poverty and undernutrition. And on the other hand, you see obesity as well. And the part of the world where I come from is a classical example. For instance, Southeast Asia, as Anna's just alluded to, 45% of the children are underweight and stunted. Well, that's a stated fact. But 85% of the mothers, of the pregnant mothers, are anemic. But on the other hand, if you look at women in the urban population, especially above a certain age group, I would say in the over 45 age group, more than 60% of them are overweight, more than 30% of them are obese. And the synergistic effect that undernutrition and overnutrition has on disease outcomes, and these, mind you, are in addition to the effects that Anne has already alluded to, because Anne has already very rightly said that undernutrition per se contributes to infectious disease mortality through different pathways. But when you have the coexistence of undernutrition with overnutrition and obesity, you see the emergence of another pattern of diseases which actually incur huge costs on the health systems of developing countries. So this is a very complicated issue, which brings us to the point that the more we can integrate interventions, because at the community level, there is just this one health worker.
And that's what you're speaking about, the burden of
exactly.
disease.
So there is the double burden of disease, and this is what is referred to as the nutrition transition.
Jay.
Well, you know, where I come from, if you are overweight, you're regarded as wealthy. It's hard to explain to someone who is overweight that they may suffer from anemia. It's quite a difficult challenge just to convince them that they have a problem. And again, we are certainly wanting to take up the issue of obesity. But you know, as Anne and Nishtha has said, the challenge for us is undernutrition. That's the big, huge challenge that faces us today. And we have to come to the issue of overnutrition, and design the interventions that are required for that. And there may be very different interventions required for us to address undernutrition. So I think there are two sides of a single spectrum, but I think we're going to come to this. And the thing is that particularly as a partnership, we're looking at working with people where our priority today is the developing world, where there's a link between poverty and undernutrition, and addressing that as the priority. So certainly, I mean, there is the challenge of overnutrition, and we need to design the interventions to that, but the priority, particularly for GAIN, is looking at undernutrition at the moment.
And just to follow up comment to that, because the correlation between economic development and poverty and levels of nutrition is very complex. It is not very simplistic that if countries will have low per capita incomes, the prevalence of undernutrition is high. Because if you see the middle-income countries, the prevalence of obesity is actually higher in the lower socioeconomic strata. And, of course, that is where you see undernutrition prevailing. So I think Jay is spot on in terms of saying that in the same household, you can have people who are obese, you can have a mother who's obese with diabetes, with hypertension, and in the same household, you can have a child who's under 5, who's stunted and malnourished.
Bernard.
As a global food company, we consider that obesity is part of our challenge. I mean, the component in our product, the fat, the sugar, is part of the problem, and we are part of it. So we cannot escape this issue. The responsibility of food company is important. So we have to tackle the issue directly through the composition of our product, and that's why we reduce. But it's not an easy issue, Reducing sugar, for example, is a cultural issue. In many countries, there is such a habit to consume sugar that you can decrease the level of sugar, but then the consumers don't buy it.
What would happen if, for instance, Danone cut its sugar content in half? So instead of 37 grams of sugar, there were only 20, maybe only 14.
We have developed in our research center a very interesting methodology to adapt the diminution of sugar with the cultural habits in order to do it step by step. If you do at one time, you do not have any impact on public health. People refuse a product, you don't sell it, it's over. If you do it step by step, you can make progress in 2, 5 years, and that's what we are doing. We have cut by per 60% the content of fat in our products in France, for example, over the past 10 years. So it's possible. You have to do it, but it's a cultural issue. It's not only technical issue. So I think we are part of the solution through our product, but also through the way we communicate on our product. And in our case, we are favorable to be quite strict on that, because if you have a real ethics on that, well, it's a competitive advantage. That's why, for example, in Europe, we were very favorable to the EU regulation on health claim, because if you invest a lot of money in R&D to support your health claim, well, you're a winner. You have a competitive advantage if you have a strong regulation, if anybody cannot claim wrong advantages or health benefits. So, well, I think it becomes a business issue and not only a social issue.
Well, we are now going to move on to phase two of our program. This is an opportunity where you get to roll up your sleeves and you get to do the work. So Daniel's going to tell you all about that.
Thanks, Michelle. So we've heard a lot now about challenges associated both with the overnutrition issue and the undernutrition issue. We've heard about the linkage about these issues to a whole range of other issues, social issues around war, famine, poverty, issues around marketing and the media, linkage to things like the cleanliness of the water and so on. Heard some great innovations and encouraging ideas about low-cost alternatives for addressing these issues. So we've heard from folks up here. Again, as Michelle said, we want to hear from you now. And again, many of you, most of you have probably been through the drill now. We want to turn to you at your tables. And again, if you've got some relatively small numbers at your tables, we're going to encourage you to kind of move to some other tables so you've got a full, rich conversation. We'd like you to come up again with two or three ideas that are really creative ideas, but also very pragmatic ideas, as specific as you can get, about ways to address some of these issues you've heard about here, or take advantage of some of the opportunities that have been talked about here on the panel or others you may be aware of. And again, for each of the ideas you come up with, we'd like to know who should be involved and what would be a concrete next step to take. And we'll be back in 25 minutes. Have a great conversation.